ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us. Let's head to the courtroom where Karen Reed's hearing is resuming after the grave concern comment was raised last week by Judge Beverly Cannone. Let's go to the courtroom.
There's a cause and effect in my mind between the several and serial inaccuracies, the break right in the middle, and then the court comes back. And I understand, I don't really, and I'm gonna get to this, see the justice in terms of this presentation to the facts. And that's what we're gonna be talking about, facts and representation. So here's what the court says. After hearing all of this, and I want to underscore something, Your Honor, and I'm not going to get too lofty with due process and notice, but it's important to hit some of these points. All of these topics that were raised were not in a motion. They were not in an affidavit. And I've had this issue before with other motions under what's required in an affidavit.
In this case?
No, I'm talking
saying generally, you've had this issue in other cases, or do you mean
other cases, Your Honor. With there not being an affidavit, right, where someone's got to be very, very careful about what they say. But in this information that Your Honor had to be subjected to was not in anything that we had notice of, these topics. We had no notice that this was coming. There was no affidavit that someone had to swear to that all of these facts were correct. And Your Honor takes the break. So we didn't get an opportunity to stand up and say, you know, what I'm being given the very fulsome opportunity to say today. So Your Honor comes back. All right. So the Commonwealth just provided the court with information. And I don't even want to repeat these words because it almost pounds on to the prejudice to the defendant, but Your Honor well knows what Your Honor said, but it certainly had the words in there that were very, very difficult on the defense. And you say, so for that reason, right? So the Commonwealth just provided the court with information that causes me, and then it goes on. So it's clear that Your Honor was relying upon that information, which was only given verbally, right? And you say, so for that reason, I'm going to suspend today so that we meet again, and then the rest will still be back in here. Unfortunately, that's not the end of the prejudice. So what happens is, all of a sudden, and Your Honor basically said, and this is all so key, so you said, I'll see you in a week from today, and then Your Honor continued on page 61. Line 12, and Mr. Brennan, where the federal authorities have been kind enough in the past to allow me to have copies of everything, would you be kind enough to call over there and check with whomever you were dealing with so to see if I can, in fact, get a copy of everything that you just read? It was only then when the reality hits that you're looking for the backup for what's being said. Up to this point, Your Honor's understanding, all of this came from the feds and the defendant didn't turn it over. So what does the Commonwealth do then? Does the Commonwealth stand up and say, whoa, wait a minute, I made a mistake, and Lord knows I've made mistakes before. They didn't stand up and say, a very significant mistake, my whole predicate for my whole presentation was, I had to even fight the feds to get this information, lo and behold, I got it, and I've been duped, and I've been ambushed. Rather than saying that, and you know what, I don't even know if I would have had the courage to say it in open court, I might have asked for a sidebar and come up and said, Your Honor, my bad, you know, this is that. But that didn't happen. So what did happen? The Commonwealth says, I can, and there's a brief chronology I think Your Honor should be aware of. So the defense is still not able to get up, but the Commonwealth is continuing on. If I could add that right now, it will take me less than a minute. The court, okay. So the Commonwealth goes on, says the chronology is December 4th. We sent another TUI request, 2024. January 6th, we filed our notice of intention to exclude ARPA experts. January 30, 2025, the United States Attorney's Office sent a response to both ours and the defense request. Without any prompting, on February 6, 2025, the defense and the prosecution received an email from the U.S. Attorney's Office saying that the contract had ended with the ARPA experts and that if either party wanted to engage, the original materials are still protected. This was a change in position about whether the party could be impeached. On February 11, we filed a motion to exclude. February 13, the defense provided us the emails that I read. Buried in a chronology is, and in the middle of a sentence is, the defense provided us with the emails. I think I said, I'm going to repeat that, I think I said, the federal government, it was the defense. February 13th, they sent us the emails in the direct examination outline. I think I said? That was the whole basis for the entire presentation, was that the Commonwealth had to fight even the feds to get that. And then it goes on. We reached out to the federal government, but you know what was not said in lines 9 through 14? What was not corrected? It wasn't corrected that the invoice came from the defense. Just emails.
I thought it meant everything, but...
I don't understand how that conclusion can be drawn, Your Honor. You didn't say the defense provided us with all of the entire production. The defense provided us the emails that I read. There was no email with the invoice. The invoice was discussed as a separate item, and I can go back to it. When the Commonwealth was talking about it, they never connected it to the emails. So then
I received a copy of it.
Pardon me?
I think it's because I received a copy of everything that had been referenced.
Yes, but I'm going to get to the point about the importance of correcting misstatements, because 3.3A1, everybody focuses on the first sentence, which is, thou shalt not make a false statement of fact to a court. The second part of 3.3A1 is, you get the opportunity to correct, and you got to correct a material. And I've got it in front of me, but I'm just paraphrasing. I want to get to precisely. But that's why I perseverate this on this, Your Honor, because I trust that the court's going to hold everybody to the same standard. And so I think there is a proper inquiry. I don't intend to be officious as to what the court should do, but if we're going to start looking at comments of defense counsel, I believe we have to look at all comments. And again, I'm going to go back to my own view is this, being a lawyer in cases like this is hard. Being a judge in cases like this is hard. Mistakes are going to be made. So we go on into page 62, line 15. We reached out to the federal government again because I was curious about the change in position on February 6th that the contract was ended but that parties could contact ARCA. Obviously, the Commonwealth is in no position to contact ARCA because that would naturally preclude the defense from retaining them. So we refrained and we will not reach out to them. This is really an interesting statement because you read it, because that would naturally preclude the defense from retaining them, yet at the same time, the Commonwealth for the fourth time has moved to strike our ability to use ARPA. So then the court goes on, all right, so the information that was provided to you, not from the federal government, so Your Honor knew at that point, I don't believe Your Honor had any basis before that to believe that it had come from the defense. I'd like a copy of it before you leave the courthouse. So I hearken back, Your Honor, to what I conclude drove Your Honor to make those impactful statements about, on the top of page 61 was the presentation of the Commonwealth that I counted had 10 misstatements, 10, before Your Honor caused the pause. So, coming to what happened then, the Commonwealth, having not giving us notice that this was coming, these topics, not putting any of these statements in an affidavit, we didn't have the ability to stand up. But I will tell you this, Your Honor, I greatly appreciated the week that we got, because I do believe that Your Honor intended that counsel be given, defense counsel and defense, a fair opportunity to go look at this. And that's the way I'll speak for myself. That's the way I took it, and I appreciated that. Because that's allowed me to go spend the time that I spend to try to do my level best to give the court an accurate rendition of the fact, because as an officer of the court, I believe that is a sacrosanct duty. And in a matter where the very issue is, what are counsel saying to the court that isn't accurate, I wanted to make sure I could do the best I can. Now, I may have made a mistake here or there, but I just want, and today, but I want to make sure that I recognize Your Honor's giving us of that week, and we've tried to take the best opportunity for it. So what happens? What happens after these 10 misdirections? The court's comments go viral. And I'm not saying this for drama's sake. I'm saying this for what has impacted the defense 6 weeks before trial starts, while jury notices are out in the mail. Those words, based upon the misdirections that your court had to endure, have gone through, and I'll just name a few, headlines in the Globe, the Herald, every TV outlet, social media exploded. And these are not trivial issues. And more than that, the veracity of counsel has been called into question. There's commentary of everybody about what's going to happen to certain members of the counsel's team, and whether it's intended or collateral damage. We've got the ARCA experts, which are key parts of our case. Their credibility is being pillared throughout the public domain. And this could have been avoided had there been an accurate recitation of what had occurred. And Your Honor, I don't know if this can be remedied. But it surely shouldn't have been exacerbated. I would now like to move rather, hopefully, efficiently through the next step, which is to point to the Massachusetts rule and give the court my view. And I have to reference, because Your Honor brought up
again, some. You don't have to tell me what you're going to do, Mr. Lessig.
I'm sorry, I'll just go ahead and do it. My apologies. So now let's just turn to Model Rule 3.381. And this applies to every counsel in this room, of course. A lawyer shall not knowingly So there's the adverb of the mens rea, knowingly. Make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal. Or fail to correct a false statement of material or fact, of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by the lawyer. So we all know the mens rea of knowingly. I don't, and this court knows it better than everybody, so I don't have to get into that. But in terms of make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal, I don't see that on behalf of the defense, and I'm going to get to the new item of February 6th, since we haven't covered that. Your Honor brought that up today. But certainly with regard to the representations that I've gone through and the statements that were made, especially on June 10th, they were 100% true and accurate at that time. They were 100% true and accurate, and that's why I went through the notebook. Or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by the lawyer. And there's no real time period that's given for the attorney. But here is something very important, Your Honor, and I'm going to parse the grammar because it's what you do in construing the statute. It says, or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by the lawyer. So the is a definite article. So it's like an adjective, it's a definite article. Lawyer is the noun. The lawyer refers to the lawyer who is perhaps made a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal. So it's sort of like you make a misstatement, it happens, but you know, you gotta correct them, right? And what they talk about is what do you have to correct? You have to correct a false statement, so it has to be false. It has to be knowingly false, of material fact or law. And material has been interpreted in the context of 3.3A1 to be a statement of fact or law that caused a court or adjudicator to have relied upon it for a determination. It's essentially what the case law talks about, that it's influenced the judge's decision. So let's go back, and even let's assume hypothetically that on June 10th there were misstatements made. It's not any misstatement. It has to be a failure to correct a material. You have to do it knowingly, and then you have to fail to correct a false statement of material fact. And in terms of what Your Honor had, it's the same lawyer that we're talking about in both clauses. And that is why I spoke about Mr. Iannetti's statements on the 10th, about what he knew, the fact that Mr. Jackson was handling the ARCA experts. So it's important to be analyzing what lawyer is saying what and which lawyer is to be making correct. To correct the statements. So I go to the analysis with regard to 3.3A1, and as I said, I'm keeping separate 3.3A1 from Rule 14 because they're different analyses, as the court knows. But I want to hit the one of the most important ones first. So there's not a false statement of fact or law to the tribunal, and I will stand here as long as Your Honor needs, if Your Honor feels differently based upon what I've said. Or fail to correct a false statement of material fact. So what I'd like to do, Your Honor, is now go to what Your Honor brought up today, because I was prepared for the June 10th. I wasn't prepared for the February 6th.
Do you need time?
I don't. I have taken the time. I appreciate the offer. But I would like to draw your attention, Your Honor, because like I provided context on June 10th, I think context for February 6th is important. And so what I'd like to do is to go back earlier than what Your Honor quoted this morning, because I think the context is important.
All right, so I have that entire transcript, like I said.
Thank you.
What page are you at?
I am starting on page 40.
Okay.
I start with line one. Mr. Brennan, correct. I had a conversation with one of the two prosecutors I spoke to, and the only means of trying to obtain information they suggested was through a TOIA request. I don't think it's the Commonwealth's obligation to seek discovery part of Rule 14, but I wanted to assist the best I could, so I made an assented to request and they responded with a letter. I think you received a copy of it. Do you mind if I share it with you? No, okay, I received it. I sent a TOIA response, essentially rejecting all of my requests on multiple grounds. So to be fair to the Commonwealth, Your Honor, this is February 6th, and they haven't gotten our discovery, right? They're just still trying to get it from the government. They don't have it from us yet. The court, all right, can I get a copy of this? If not, I just need, and then Ms. Bugalton, you can retain that copy. Thank you. So I'm not going to stay here and read it right now, but all right, Mr. Brennan, of course. And so inevitably, I'm not making any motion right now, but I appreciate that as the proponent of the evidence, defense's obligation to give Rule 14 discovery. I do not think, even despite their testimony, they've complied with Rule 14, and so the reason I forecast this was because I appreciate the April 1st trial date. If the defense, through no fault of their own, is unable to comply with the discovery, I think that we're entitled under Rule 14. I will at that point move to preclude the witnesses. So I think the important in this snapshot in time is all of the discussion that occurred on February 18th, and I'm going to underscore this, that presentation was not about the substance of what was in the email. The Commonwealth never had an issue with that. It was all about they had to get it from the federal government and we didn't turn it over. Your Honor obviously has read the February 18th transcript. You can draw your own conclusions. But on February 18th, they were not on the issue of anything other than they thought that they didn't get the material from us. So now we continue on the court. Move to exclude the witnesses? Mr. Brennan, yes. The court, what do you say, Mr. Jackson? Mr. Jackson, I don't want the witnesses excluded. What do you want me to say? The court, I asked you all to try and work out something. The original protective order permitted that we can do in court anything that would rule. I expect you to say something a little more than that because, and Mr. Jackson, well, I'll wait to get this motion. The court, all right, last time, Mr. Jackson, let me put it this way. The court, hold on a second. Last time we did voir dire of these witnesses, it seemed to me that that was the logical conclusion. I'd be able to get both sides discovered. We did that. That seems like a logical alternative to the exclusion, right? Your Honor knows what you're doing here. I guess we can wait and see if I exclude it on a motion to exclude. It just makes sense to me to set that up now rather than wait. I don't know when they do that, when the Commonwealth, based on their witness list, or calls them, is that when you want to exclude it, so I sort of expected the defense would have some suggestion. If you don't, you don't. Mr. Jackson, and this is the key context. I can tell you this, the Commonwealth has exactly, this is an interesting and sort of different set of witnesses. The Commonwealth is saying that pursuant to Rule 14 and, you know, exclusion and preclusion of a witness is a punitive sanction for Rule 14 violations, Ms. Reed has not violated anything. Why should she be penalized when the Commonwealth has the exact same batch of information that we have about these witnesses? And there's more context to that. I understand the import of these words so far. So I don't have any more information. I don't have any additional discovery. I didn't hire them. I didn't ask them to engage in additional protocols. So I've got nothing else to give to Mr. Brennan. He's got the same information I got and he got at the same time. What Mr. Jackson is referring to here is the disclosures from the U.S. government, not the disclosures that were going to occur on February 12th and 13th when we would get the certificate. We had the certificate of completion of discovery. We had 30 days, technically, to turn it over, but it got turned over on the 12th. So then it continues on, is important. The court, if I don't exclude it with other sides seeking a voir dire, we would not seek a voir dire because they're eminently qualified and there's no other discovery to give. They've provided. The federal authorities provided all the discovery that was attended to their analysis and testimony. So What we have in terms, Your Honor, this is important, and I'm going to go right back to 3.3a. We have Ms. Little handling all the discovery. Mr. Jackson is not sorting through discovery, knowing what we got, not recalling what is in the possession from March 22nd, not recalling all of those items. That was Ms. Little's responsibility. So what happens? What happens is Ms. Little handles the production, goes back and does the diligence that she always does, takes all that material, sends it over to the Commonwealth. On February 18th, the defense did not have the opportunity to address the issues that Mr. Brennan had brought up. But I now want to go to the statute and why it is important. Because the whole issue of discovery, the whole issue of batches of information was provided. And it was provided before, well before the 18, before any of these issues came up. And Your Honor, respectfully, whatever the court may consider to have been an inaccurate statement, there is no knowing misstatement of fact. Mr. Jackson has never, I can tell you this from personal experience, I don't see him ever touch one item of discovery in terms of here's what we're going to collect, here's what we're going to turn over. Never have I seen it happen. I've spoken with him, he can speak for himself. That's not, so there's, even if you take any read of February 6th, Mr. Jackson is focusing on and thinking the discovery is just what everybody has from the federal government. You've heard this many times. We can't produce more than the feds have, but we certainly, and I want to hit this head on, we certainly had those March 22nd, we had those emails at the time that statement was made. We had those. We had the direct, we had the qualms, not running away from that. But the question is, at the time Mr. Jackson made those statements, he's focusing on the government, and he's not knowingly saying in his mind, oh, well, I know we've got these emails from way back when. And so with regard to the shell not knowingly, there's no evidence of knowingly here. And I don't believe, respectfully, there can be an inference stated. When I've looked at every single case where the court can look at the circumstances. So knowingly is not merely a subjective question of what an attorney has. The court is entitled to look at the circumstances in this. The case law says should make an objective determination on knowingly. But the cases, and I can give them to Your Honor, the cases are legion, that the court cannot draw an inference from no fact to conclude it was knowing. They got to have some basis, and I'll give you some examples. What happens is if, let's say somebody, one of the leading cases is, unfortunately, a woman attorney was in a bad divorce, she had financial statements, and she made misstatements of fact about the financial statements. And then the question became, did she knowingly know it? And what the court did, she said, no, I didn't know it, I didn't remember it, I was under psychological stress. And what the court did was they went and they looked at the circumstances and saw emails and conversations she had with her accountant where she clearly knew about those statements and she told the court she did. So there's an example of you've got to have circumstances that the court cannot just jump from a lawyer said this to it's knowingly without some basis. That's why the mens rea is there. So in turn, and that's the only, the February 6th, respectfully, that's the only aspect, and I went through all the others, that even comes close to a false statement of fact by Mr. Unetti or Mr. Jackson. In sum, Mr. Unetti's statements on June 10th, all completely accurate. All completely accurate. Mr. Jackson's eliciting of the direct testimony at trial, when he asked, have I ever asked you specifically, you know, questions, etc. That's completely true because it was Dr. Wolf who sent the questions in. So we now are left with February 6th, and I've given you that construction of the statute. My last point, Your Honor, is going to go to the Rule 14, which is, and I'm going to spend a very short amount of time on this, now that the Commonwealth knows that the discovery came from the defense, I want to go back to, please, the February 18th transcript, because I want to keep separate analytically the ARCA from defense counsel, because obviously for Ms. Reed is obviously very concerned about her defense counsel and her choice of counsel, which is going to be my last legal point. But in terms of what occurred, I want to go to and quote the Commonwealth on the transcript. I am on page 62, line 18. Obviously, and by the way, this is toward the very end of the 18. Obviously, the Commonwealth is in no position to contact, etc., etc. And what does that relate to? If Your Honor would go back to page 60, line 13. And it's a repeat, but I didn't get to the point here. I don't care if the ARCA witnesses testify at trial. I don't care about their opinions. But I care that it's unfair, imbalanced, and hidden, and the Commonwealth, like the defense, is entitled to discovery. Key line. So, if they can produce the discovery, I welcome ARCA. I want to repeat that.
You don't need to.
I'm sorry. Okay. So my point is, we produced the discovery. Why is there still an issue with ARCA? These aren't my words. So I want to cover, before I get to the Sixth Amendment issues, the point that ARCA should be allowed to testify. We've complied with our Rule 14 obligations. There's no prejudice. They have the discovery. They've obviously had from the government a long time everything about ARCA. So I want to touch that base to make sure that either intended or collateral damage, that ARCA still gets to testify, because it's a key part of the defense here. Now to the Sixth Amendment. The United States Supreme Court has held repeatedly that a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to defense counsel of their choice is a root basis of the Sixth Amendment. Is it an absolute right? No, Your Honor. If counsel does something so egregious, does it correct it? The Sixth Amendment gives way to the need for the court to have candor, the need for the court to have decorum in the courtroom. So I understand that. My presentation today was, as an advocate, of course, foremost, but also to provide all the information. So when Your Honor balances that sacrosanct Sixth Amendment right with whether or not there has been such a level of conduct that can be diluted or trumped. And I give Your Honor United States versus Gonzalez-Lopez, 548 U.S. 140, 2006. And in that case, there was violations of the local rule. And the court and the court struck their counsel for that. And the
is
U.S.
Supreme Court pro hoc vice, or is that wrong?
I'm going to get to that. The answer is the counsel. I want to be sure my answer. Yes. And I'm going to read my conclusion, because it doesn't say Pearl Hawk Beach yet, but I'm going to read you a part of it that says, during the hearing, however, the magistrate judge revoked Lowe's, that's the attorney, provisional acceptance. So I believe that's the parlance of Pearl Hawk Beach, but Your Honor, I'm pretty sure, but I'm not 100% sure. And then the following week, et cetera, et cetera, and then the revocation occurred. And yes, it was. So the Supreme Court holding, government conceded that Gonzalez's Sixth Amendment right was violated below, where the court denied Pro Hoc Vice admission based on perceived violations of a local court rule.
All right, so Pro Hoc Vice was not permitted in. It wasn't a revocation of Pro Hoc Vice. There's a difference.
There is obviously a difference, and both occurred in this case.
Okay.
There was both. Good point, both. So, Your Honor, and there are other cases. When you have the Sixth Amendment, the fact that someone is pro hoc vice status is not the determining factor. The Sixth Amendment, in terms of legal dignity, is way up here, and then the pro hoc and the local rules are down here. It's only when the violations that undergird the pro hoc vice get more than repetitive, but go to things that are done that aren't corrected. And the issues that I've seen in my research, Your Honor, is that they have to be so, the violations have to drive so much to the core issues in the case. It's like suborning perjury, putting people on the stand when they know they're wrong, literally having objective evidence that counsel had a document in their hands, almost literally at the same time they're telling the court they don't have it. It has to be that severity to trump the Sixth Amendment. And why is that, Your Honor? Because the court has alternative remedies for if they really think that is happening. And that is going to be my last point on the Sixth Amendment. The case law is replete with the trial court having to be careful that whatever they do, even if they believe there's a basis for some sanctions, that the court look to do them post-trial so that there is not, for the trial, the bleeding in of those issues into pretrial matters. And the case law, there's a mention of that all the time. It encourages the trial courts to make sure that they're very, very sensitive to that issue. I don't think the courts are being all that sensitive and empathetic to the lawyers, but I think what they're doing is appropriately trying to make sure the defendant gets a fair trial, right? And the defendant is not adversely affected by whatever the counsel may or may not have done. But I want to be very careful and clear, Your Honor. I'm not saying that is sort of like mitigation. I'm saying, importantly, the time I spent that there was not these violations. If any occurred, they were corrected. And on Rule 14, there's no prejudice. And therefore, I conclude, Your Honor, and I would urge the court. What happened on February 18th, there were some misstatements and they weren't cured. I don't want this to turn into, and I'm not making this argument, I'm not making an equivalence argument. I'm not saying, okay, now let's turn to the Commonwealth. To the contrary, Your Honor, and I hope I've provided a factual and legal basis. I don't want any of this to continue. I don't want scrutiny of the Commonwealth statements on February 18th unless there's going to be continued state scrutiny of the defense counsel. And I don't say this as a camouflage or a shield. We've got a lot to do between now and April 1st. The last thing I'm sure the court wants or anybody wants is to have something happen where that date can't be met because of whatever actions come out of this. My hope is that we all understand we make mistakes. Mistakes have been made clearly by both parties. And I would urge that the parties, not talking about the court, the parties take a breath, a deep breath, and focus on the matters that are important, which is how can we prepare to make sure that the presentations to the jury are candid, truthful, and most importantly, effective, so that jury can make the best decision. There's a lot at stake here. The issues are momentous, and that is the focus of the defense. And I, again, conclude, but I would ask that I have, if anything said, if Your Honor has any concerns, I would really appreciate hearing them so I can take them on. Mr. Jackson, Mr. Urnetti, any questions Your Honor has, I would greatly appreciate it, my presentation notwithstanding. If there's still concerns with the court, we will take them on as best we can, and certainly candidly. Thank you.
All right, I appreciate that. Before I give the Commonwealth an opportunity to respond, I need 10 minutes.
All rise.
Lesson, I am going to take you up on your offer to ask any questions, and I may have questions for both sides next week. But actually, what I want to do, and you said I could ask questions of other counsel. So while memories are fresh, I just want to assure the accuracy of what was just said. So I'm certainly not going to order counsel to answer my questions. You don't have to, but I am curious. So we're going to start with you, Mr. Urnetti.
Yes, sir.
As an officer of the court, is there anything that you dispute that you just heard from Mr. Alessi? And what I'm particularly concerned about is what you knew or what you didn't know?
No, what he said was entirely accurate.
Okay. Mr. Jackson, same questions.
No, and I would simply elucidate with regard to the February 6th sidebar comment. As I look back at the, I didn't remember making the comment one way or the other. I didn't remember that sidebar.
I did.
I'm sure the court did after it looked at the transcript.
No,
I did as well.
No, I did long before I looked at the transcript.
Right. The context of that, what was in my brain when I said we don't have anything else to give, which when I reviewed the transcript, was very clearly the federal batch of information, what we call, refer to as the federal dump. I did not have in my head at all emails, communications, things of that nature, the small...
Invoices, payment?
No, nothing. I was, because the context of what Mr. Brennan was talking about being frustrated about were his TUI requests concerning the federal batch of information, and that's when I was making the additional statement, we don't have anything that they don't have concerning the federal information and the background information for the ARCA experts. That was it.
Your Honor, if I could, this is the...
No, okay. Hold on. Ms. Little, it was just thrown on you that you're responsible for all discovery. But the same question, you, and again, you don't have to answer, but is there anything that you dispute in the accuracy of what Mr. Alessi told me about what you knew and what you didn't know and when?
No, Your Honor, I would just add that as soon as the court issued the order, I obviously was not in court that day, but as soon as the court issued the order that ARCA reciprocal discovery be provided, I gathered those documents and I provided it. So that was the, I guess, prompt for going to look to see if we could satisfy the 10 things that were outlined by Mr. Brennan.
Okay. So I'm going to hear from the Commonwealth now. It does not look like we'll finish this today because we'll be ending around 4 o'clock. But I will hear you, Mr. Brennan.
Attorney Alessi ended his argument talking about the Sixth Amendment and discounting repeated or repetitive violations. When you consider the conduct in this case, you should consider the history of the case, including repetitive violations, week 1-6 violations, protective order violations, and then discovery violations, representation violations. The defense in the first trial attempted and successfully did portray ARCA witnesses as wholly independent presented themselves as oblivious to the nuances of ACRA, left the impression that there was no compensation, no bias, no collaboration. They postured the information that they gave in advance of the second trial, and I'm going to get to the timing of that, but it ignores entirely withholding this information before the first trial. The defendant presumed innocent has a right to a fair trial, and so do the people of the Commonwealth. It is clear from a reading of the transcripts and the records and the posturing materials that there was information that showed that ARCA was not wholly independent. It's information that was known to the defense, and for whatever reason, perhaps a strategic advantage, was not provided to the Commonwealth, the court, nor the jury. Mr. Attorney Alisi talks about the Gonzalez case. In that case, there was one attorney to cross-examine a witness, which is protocol, another attorney passed a note, a minor violation of a court procedure. That is like a raindrop in a hurricane. We have a code of ethics and rules to ensure a fair trial for everybody, both sides. Coming in at the last hour and providing information when the avalanche has started is not enough. This isn't just about Rule 14. My effort with the ARCA witnesses from the beginning, and I've been clear and consistent, is not to preclude them, is to get fair discovery that we're entitled to. I did not know before a few weeks ago what the defense had known. I did not know that there was conversations and efforts made between them and then inevitably compensation paid. I didn't know that, but I certainly suspected it. I saw Your Honor's questions before voir dire, during voir dire, after voir dire. I remember the conversations side by. And those questions were right to the point. And when we were sidebar, I specifically mentioned, I don't know, a voir dire is inconsequential. I don't know what to ask. I can't send them back home to get their records or their emails or any billing. All of that was denounced. All of that was portrayed as baseless. But the court had questions. I had many of the same questions. It is not a surprise that we start to scratch off the tip of the iceberg. It is not complete. There is a murky relationship between the defense and the United States Attorney's Office relative to these ARCA witnesses, and there is a very unclear relationship as we stand here right now between the history of interaction between the defense and these ARCA witnesses. You can see from the emails, while there is some information provided, there are gaps. There are enormous gaps in time. The pause moment on March 24th and then reinitiating on May 5th, where ARCA is actually billing the defense for their works before the voir dire. There had to have been communication between that time that rekindled this relationship. There are two requests that are mentioned in the emails. We didn't get all of those responses. And so we do not have an affidavit from either counsel or any of the counsels. We did not hear a word from any of them. According to Mr. Alisi, what you should do, what the court should do, is go to the federal government and ask
questions. So just to be clear, I am not having ex parte communications with anyone about this case. So I'm totally rejecting your request that I do that, Mr. Alisi.
It wasn't a request, Your Honor.
You suggested that I call them.
No, I said if Your Honor wanted to do that. I didn't suggest that Your Honor.
I'll move on, but the point is, it is not incumbent on the court to provide the proof that the defense was given the opportunity to bring in today to clarify the record. Instead, it is the typical 101, blame everybody but themselves. There's no acknowledgement, there's no contrition, and there's no confidence that we are going to get all the materials that we're entitled to. To suggest that Archer's position did not change, it did change. Their opinions did change by the time they reached trial. It is not that the defense brought out that there was an expert in lighting or crashes happen at night. It is the bias, the relationship that is critical, and that was hidden from the court, the Commonwealth, and the jury. It is the bias and the leaning towards one side that was not disclosed. It doesn't help the first trial to disclose it last week or 10 days ago. So let me offer a quick history. It is true, when I first spoke to the court, I believed the documents provided by the federal government, and I did correct that record as soon as I learned before court ended for the day. January 30th, 2025, the United States Attorney's Office responded to one of my two requests. They provided billing, including ARCA billing. There was billing for their reconstruction, but there was no billing provided for their preparation, the voir dire preparation, travel expenses, trial testimony. That information was provided to both sides on January 30th, 2025. It seemed at that point that the federal government was being at least a little more responsive, although not correctly. No bills other than what the ARCA experts did in putting together their demonstration and their accident reconstruction. February 11th, I filed on behalf of the Commonwealth our motion to exclude the ARCA witnesses. On February 12th, the United States Attorney's Office gives us new emails. And those emails were between the defense and the United States Attorney's Office regarding their request to use ARCA witnesses at trial. It's not a surprise that on February 13th, on the heels of these more productive disclosures by the federal government, we then received the disclosures from the defense, which are the emails regarding conversations between Attorney Jackson and Dr. Wolf, and the invoice for billing. Now, I did misspeak, I corrected it, but it is not the source of that information. It is the substance of that information which is critical and relevant. It is that information that should have been known to the court, the Commonwealth, and the jury at the first trial. And it is also that information, when you compare it to the representations that have been made prior to trial by the defense, that has import. Before, and I'm not going to belabor this and go through the comments, most of them again, but it is important before I get to the representations. The court does consider Prolocuce. We have one licensed attorney in Massachusetts who's carrying three Prolocuce attorneys with the request for a fourth to ride on that same license. There is a responsibility, especially to Attorney Anetti, fine attorney, an excellent attorney who I admire, but there is a responsibility so that there are not a number of Prolocuce lawyers doing different things and then later plausible deniability. When we send emails, if I should miss one person on an email, I will receive an email telling me that make sure everybody gets every communication. I've been corrected or redirected many times when we've left somebody out on a communication. Pleadings are signed by all parties. They come through the bar card on that table. And so to try to parse or mince or put a slight on words to suggest that things are done independently and there's no responsibility for the defense when a representation is made that's inaccurate isn't enough. It doesn't assure that in the future it won't continue. Now, Mr. Alisi said there were rules of the road. This was before his time and mine, but I've read the discovery. There were no rules of the road. There was a protective order. And the protective order was clear that there was no discussion outside of court about the federal material, and there was nothing in the protective order or direction from the U.S. Attorney's Office that the Commonwealth had any right or privilege to contact any witnesses. Everything is done by the book, by regulation, through TUI requests.
So I have to say, I've never seen the protective order. I received a stack of discovery that the federal authorities were kind enough to get to me in advance of trial last time, because Mr. Jackson had told me he understood that I was operating from a place that I didn't have enough knowledge, essentially, of what was going on. So I received those 3,000 pages plus. I did not receive a protective order. I don't know that I'm entitled to it. but it would be helpful. I don't want to take it if I'm not entitled to it. I don't know what the parameters are.
Your Honor, we have a copy of the protective order. I did ask the counsel if there was any limitations to it, and we don't. I don't have a certain answer. What I'd like to do is
call
inquire.
There, please. Yeah. All right, if I can have it, I'd like it. It would help guide me through this. If I can't have it, I'll just go with everything I'm doing.
May I have a moment to speak to counsel?
Sure.
That's the latest from the Karen Reed hearing and Judge Beverly Cannone and all of the characters in this saga. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any breaking updates on this case and others. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA. Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited. Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces. I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA. Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited. Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.